Democrats won back the House and Republicans remain in control of the Senate. So does that mean Americans are in for a whole lot of gridlock? Not necessarily.
It's been a bloodbath for oil, and traders are talking about a short squeeze in this trade, which is evident, as you can see, in the price action. Behind this move is the fact that everyone's pumping. We've seen this movie before.
It's going to be really hard for Congress, whether controlled by Republicans or Democrats, to make those individual tax cuts permanent next year. They're going to be faced with a $1 trillion deficit, so they're going to want to try to pay for those.
This is a very different midterm election. It's really a presidential confidence vote. So I don't know that the it's also a rather intense time. There's a lot of anxiety at this point, a lot of anger.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, crude oil in bear territory. It's hard to believe that over a month ago, it was almost over $85. The elections, the Dems recapture the House, so we now have gridlock in a divided Congress in Washington, which is going to make those tax cuts, and you can forget about tax cuts 2.0, and also trade barriers. That's going to be more difficult going forward. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Gary Dorsch will be joining me in the first hour. He's saying the markets are getting ready for a run. Maybe all those stock buybacks, which are supposed to be a record, almost $1 trillion this year, could propel stocks higher. They're driving these earnings increases, third quarter earnings coming in close to 25%. And he said, next year we're heading into Russian roulette, the Fed versus stimulus. He expects treasuries to get up to 4%. But the good news, at least for the holidays, we're heading into that seasonal period of the year when it's a good time for stocks. And later on, Kathy Derbys will be joining me as we take a look at the physical bullion market in gold and silver. Kathy thinks we're at a pivot point here in the gold markets, especially if the dollar begins to weaken. We need a catalyst, she says, and one may be on the way with these budget deficits approaching $1 trillion. We're going to talk about what's going on in the gold and silver bullion mark, and we'll talk about that. What has happened to silver? Is silver a buy at these levels? Well, some smart people seem to be buying, one of them a major investment bank. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And in hour two, the big picture, the midterm elections have changed the political makeup of Washington this week. What will a divided Congress mean for the economy and the markets? And in today's big picture, Jim Poplava and myself discuss the headwinds to Trump's tax and infrastructure plans and the key proposals for compromise in 2019. Also in the big picture, we discuss Cold War 2.0 and a movement toward what could be a great power confrontation between the U.S. and China. That's coming up in hour two, the big picture. Well, let's turn to the market wrap report for the week with Ryan Poplava. We finished the week with U.S. equities mainly higher as we continue to recover from the correction in October and this week post the midterm elections Tuesday. The S&P 500 was up 2.13%, the Dow Industrials up 2.84%, and the NASDAQ Composite up 0.68%. But Ryan, what can you tell us about the market's reaction this week to the midterm elections?
Well, Chris, we typically see the markets rally after the midterm election, and that seemed to be the case this week with a big push on Wednesday following those results. Now, the market abhors uncertainty, and just like we saw in the 2016 elections with the uncertainty leading into those elections between who was going to be president, Hillary or Trump, and we saw what happened then. It's the same case this time around, and we've rallied very strongly post those results once the market got clarity. So another note is that historically, the stock market has done well in years with a Republican president and a split Congress. And so I think those two things kind of played hand in hand with leading to the market rally. And of course, like you mentioned, the correction last month, we're still in that kind of rebound process. And so to see where things are going to go from here, we're going to have to keep watching some of the key levels like those 50-day moving averages and the 200-day moving average. But overall, the market did respond very favorably to those results.
So now that the midterm elections are behind us, Ryan, and most of the third quarter earnings season, what would you say is on the horizon for this market until year end?
So some of the really big catalysts this year, Chris, have been trade as well as the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. And we had a meeting this week. And looking at that, I think that that will continue to be a catalyst that, looking at this week, the market was able to absorb. The statement that came out this week showed that the Fed wasn't really fazed by the market volatility last month and only adjusted one small note in their policy statement that business investment had moderated in the third quarter. So really not fazed at all by it. And so that's led the market to believe, looking at the Fed futures, that we're looking at another rate hike here in December right around the corner. So what's up ahead? Possibly another Fed rate hike in December. Quite possibly, I'd say. Actually, there's like a 76% chance of that. As I said, really no mention of China or the U.S. trade or concerns over maybe higher rates and or higher inflationary pressures. And as I mentioned in September, the market hadn't adjusted to the new dot plot estimation and continues even right now, despite this Fed meeting, with a probability next year that we get three rate hikes. And that probability is right around 34%. And that really hasn't budged over the last month. The other thing is that the 2 to 10 year curve has flattened again. As of late, we're right back down to 26 basis points at the end of this week. Now, concerning China and trade, it's been viewed that the split Congress will continue to support Trump against China, according to Reuters, but they will probably scrutinize more of our negotiations with our allies, trying to make sure that we're a lot more diplomatic, probably get a lot more negative feedback from the Democrats coming in if Trump isn't able to really smooth things out with our allies. Now, the Trump administration is still set to sit down with President Xi at the G20. This will be the last week of November, but Larry Kudlow this week really dampened expectations for an immediate trade solution. And if you recall last week, there were a lot of rumors that trade deals were being drafted. He said, no, they're not, adamantly. So that led to some market weakness early in the week on Monday. Now, China's equity markets immediately dropped as a result of those comments. So I think what you're going to see from here, Chris, any kind of rumor or a headline regarding trade has the potential to kind of stoke or depress equities. We've seen it last week. It was a big up and down week on some of those rumors. And here we are at the beginning of the week, seeing comments from Kudlow really affecting the tape, especially those Chinese stocks. So I think that will continue to play out this year.
And the Fed and trade both seem to be ongoing catalysts for the market, with more developments to come later this month for the latter. But apart from the elections and the FOMC meeting, it looks like natural gas prices and oil were all over the place this week. What's going on there?
Well, I think the most exciting news or event I saw happening this week was really the volatility in energy. And that was due to a couple of things, Chris. On Monday, there was a Weather Channel article that caused natural gas prices just to skyrocket. I forget what they closed at, but at one point I saw them up 10% on Monday. And the article said that they expect forecasts for colder than average temperatures to kick off November. And if you understand, November to April is the withdrawal season. So that's why any kind of news that will have colder weather, seeing more severe draw on inventories, you know, that's causing prices to go up. And before that article hit, it was already known that gas storage in the previous week was very low, and the cumulative levels right now are at the lowest levels we've seen in 15 years. So that's quite the bullish setup for natural gas prices. So inventories were up this week, more than the last, but regardless, prices were up nicely, and even more so on Friday. I was reading some more articles that the current cold snap is in place, but it is expected to move out sometime next week between November 16th and 17th. However, there's a view right now that there's another system kind of moving down that may be replacing it, and that's what caused prices to move up again on Friday. Another item on energy, again, energy, a big item on the list this week, was the back and forth on Iranian sanctions. There wasn't so much back and forth, but mainly that it was announced 8 countries would get a waiver, and those sanctions did go into effect this week. So, looking looking at oil about a month ago, there was all these expectations that we would be seeing these sanctions put on Iranian production, and how much would OPEC maybe cover some of that. And now we're seeing that Iran's going to be able to produce somewhere between 1.3 million barrels per day to its countries that are importing it. So I guess there was this headline from Bloomberg this week that OPEC and allies were discussing production cuts for next year. That caused our oil to jump up 2.4% intraday. But another inventory build saw crude close negative on the day. And so a lot of volatility in oil this week. But as a whole, if you look at the past 10 trading days, oil has been trading down consecutively almost every day. But again, about a month ago, if you recall, Chris, you and I talked about this, where analysts were downgrading their estimates. Originally, they were looking at $100 oil when all this was going on. Iranian production being sanctioned, OPEC not really quite able to produce as much because there were some issues in South America. But here we are, much lower prices. And in fact, some are calling it already a bear market percentage-wise. One other item this week, pot stocks. Got a jump on Jeff Sessions resigning. But what looks to be his replacement, Matthew Whitaker, has really a mixed record on it. So prices kind of came back in a little bit.
Well, Ryan, we do thank you for that report. We'll look forward to having you in the studio next week on our weekly market wrap. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Now, why is the stock market rising? Because companies are buying their stocks back, reducing the stock of stocks that are available for investors to buy with their tax cuts. And you have something like 80% of the stocks held in the United States held by the top 5, 10% of the population. So you've got the corporations decapitalizing, and you've got the shareholding population doing well. And you have a lot of other people who really still aren't seeing increases, significant increases in their incomes. So you still have a lot of problems there. All of that doesn't matter. What matters is the perceptions.
Well, winds of change have come to Washington. With the Democrats now controlling the House and the Republicans the Senate, we have gridlock in divided government. The market seemed to like that, rallying very strongly on Wednesday. What does this mean going forward? Because we just started the 2020 presidential election cycle. Joining me on the phone is Gary Dorsch. Gary, let's begin with the market in the correction that we saw in October, the second major correction that we've had this year. Any thoughts on what just happened and what that might mean for the future as we begin?
Well, the correction in October looks quite a bit like the correction in February of this year. Both corrections seemingly came out of nowhere, largely unexpected. And they both occurred, however, during a time period known as a blackout period, in which the major S&P 500 companies are prohibited from buying back their own stock. So if you're looking for a short sale or an opportunity for any type of little pullback or correction, that's the optimal time when we're in that two-week blackout period. And of course, there's always a reason why the market does what it does. A lot of people find those after the fact. And the excuses used in the month of October in reviewing some of the articles that were written just a few weeks ago was all about the fear about a trade war with China and higher interest rates and a tighter Fed policy. And those are pretty much the same arguments and fears that were expressed earlier this year. And as it turned out, on the day the market actually hit bottom about a week and a half ago, Monday morning, a week and a half ago, I have to hand it to Goldman Sachs. They did put out a contrarian view, expecting a 6% rebound in the S&P 500 when all the commentary was negative. And they did indicate that the reason they had turned bullish was the blackout period was lifting for many companies as earnings season got underway. And Earlier today, JP Morgan reporting that buybacks are at record levels on their trading desk. And so, you know, this market is essentially trading off of blackout periods and buybacks. The expectation now is that S&P 500 companies will buy back about $760 billion worth of their own stock for this year, 2018. And earlier this morning, once again, Goldman Sachs reporting or predicting that buybacks will increase 22% next year to about $940 billion. So it's a shrinking market. Companies are retiring their shares. It's very difficult to be a long-term short seller in a shrinking market. But on the other hand, what is causing the anxiety, I think, on the downside when we do see times when the market takes a swoon, is fear that the Fed is going to make a policy mistake by tightening too far, too much. And higher interest rates are the number one threat to this bull market. And the Fed is not only raising short-term interest rates, they are draining $50 billion a month at the current pace of quantitative tightening. And that is putting upward pressure on bond yields. Corporate bond yields have risen steadily in the last several weeks and to their highest level in many years, 8 to 10 years. And for many companies, those that are highly leveraged are looking at almost junk bond yields for even some major companies in the corporate bond market. So as these two forces are in conflict with each other, one bullish, the buybacks, and the Fed negative, at least for now. And that's where we're getting the whipsaw effect. However, if you buy a 10% pullback and you're strictly a technical analyst, and you don't pay attention to the news, you just watch the price and the price action. Anytime you have bought the S&P after a 10% pullback, you have invariably made money in 3 to 6 months down the road. And that has been a continuous pattern now during the length of this bull market. So ultimately, as long as the economy remains strong and there's no signs of a recession, pullbacks that are generated by fears of higher interest rates are bought by technical analysts and traders who follow these things. And of course, the companies themselves are the biggest buyers, having bought over $4.5 trillion of their own stock since 2009. And they are providing enormous support for this market, regardless of whatever negative news that comes out.
I want to turn my attention to another market. And Gary, one thing that happened in February, we saw it happen in the recent downturn in the stock market last month. Typically up until this year, when stocks went through a correction, either the flash crash 2011, 2015, you had the Treasury market rally. That did not happen in February. It did not happen this time. So I'd like to get your thoughts on interest rates and where they might be headed.
Well, that's an excellent point. In the past, whenever you would see a significant pullback, such as we've seen earlier this year, you would have seen a notable decline in long-term interest rates and what is called the flight to safety. And as you point out, that did not happen. And one of the biggest dangers, I think, for the U.S. economy going forward is the fact that the U.S. Treasury is going to be issuing $1 trillion or more of fresh debt every year, for as far as the eye can see. And as a result, the Treasury market is no longer a safe haven. It's a trap for anyone that thinks that they can find safety there. I believe the massive Treasury borrowing plus the Fed's reducing of its bond portfolio will push up interest rates. I see the 10-year currently at around 3.22%, easily rising to my target of 3.25 to 3.5, which has been my target since the beginning of the year. We're just about there now, but I see it going even higher yet to 4% by the end of next year, possibly even higher than that. And mortgage rates currently bumping at 5% for a 30-year conventional, assuming you have good credit. And I like to see how the housing market begins to perform when mortgage rates rise to 6, 6.5%. And there's even more upward pressure on the London interbank offering rate, which is where many mortgages are priced. The LIBOR rates are going up even higher than Treasury rates, so put even more upward pressure on mortgage rates. So higher interest rates, especially higher mortgage rates, if that leads to a decline in housing prices nationwide, that would be the first sign, in my opinion, that a sharp slowdown in the economy is on the horizon. And already there's reports that housing prices are falling in San Francisco and Seattle, probably the most highest priced in the country, but they're starting to come down now and demand is slackening off there. So the Fed is bumping up into restrictive territory. It'll continue to do so. And of course, we'll watch the yield curve, see how it reacts to further Fed tightening.
Let's take a look at another market, and that's commodities. It's hard to believe that oil has gone into a bear market within just a month, where if we go back 30 days at the beginning of October, we had West Texas Intermediate crude at $75.76. Brent was in the 80s. And now you take a look, where it looks like almost a bear market in just a month. So what's your take on oil? And let's begin with oil and then maybe move on to gold and other commodities.
Well, the big surprise was the drop in oil prices, down about 20% from its recent highs. Beginning in the month of October, that was perhaps in synchronization with the drop in world equity markets. But yet we see world equity markets turning up in the last week and a half, but oil prices not following suit. They're continuing to fall. And North Sea Brent, a key support on the front month at 70 and a half a barrel. If it should break 70 and a half, the charts would look quite negative. It could drop another $5 or so from there. Of course, there's always a reason for why the markets do things. The commodities tend to be more logical in evaluating fundamentals than stocks nowadays. And so the key reason was the Trump administration surprised everybody by granting exemptions from sanctions on the purchases of Iranian oil and gave eight countries the permission to go ahead and buy, I guess, up to about 1.5 million barrels a day of Iranian oil as part of this exemption. That was surprising. I think the market was pricing in a complete embargo, complete sanctioning of all Iranian exports, which would have taken a total of 2.5 million barrels off the market. The Saudis were trying to compensate, but they were being stretched very thin. And of course, as you mentioned, an election was coming up in the month of October for the November 6th elections. And the president was glad to see the price of gasoline plummeting in the wholesale market and the futures market, but might not have been in time enough for the retail price. But in any event, the granting of allowance of eight countries to buy some Iranian oil is what I believe was the main impetus for the knockdown. So what the Trump administration wants to do is to restrict further Iranian sales as U.S. oil production picks up in the months and year ahead. U.S. oil production hit a record high of 11.6 million barrels a day last week. That's up 400,000 since the beginning of the year. It's a dramatic increase in such a short period of time. And the prediction is it'll hit 12 million within the next 6 months, another 400,000 increase. And so if that is the case, there'll be further tightening of those sanctions. And for other countries, we'll see a revision of their exemptions, permitting them to buy fewer barrels of Iranian oil. So it's an attempt to try to keep oil prices steady while at the same time gradually tightening the noose around Iran's oil exports. So
given that, do you think that we stay down in this low area, head lower, or could this reverse itself?
Well, there's even talk now that Saudi Arabia and Russia may have to cut back on some of their oil supplies to try to prevent a further deterioration in the price. Those are the fundamentals and the price movements that we can argue have already been discounted. These exemptions at current prices may have been fully discounted. And so this news is old news and not good enough to use for future trading. I would have to strictly rely on the charts, let the market tell you where it's going to go. And as I'm looking at the North Sea Brent crude oil chart right now, the key support is in the 70.5 to 71 a barrel for the front month. If it should break that, I see a further drop to 67.5, perhaps 65. If, on the other hand, we have buyers come in, we see stability, then I would guess we're going to go back up. Longer term, I think the price of oil will eventually go back up. That's because the demand for oil continues to increase every year due to the massive increase in the world's population and the world economy being relatively, well, uneven at best in certain parts of the world slowing down. But here in the U.S., very strong. And overall, I think the demand will kick in and keep the price relatively high. So if there is a decline to 67.5, I would think that might be the bottom for North Sea Brent, only another $3 down, and then a rebound back to 75. And U.S. oil will continue to lag North Sea Brent. Actually, the spread is an enormous $10 a barrel between the two, and that's because the U.S. Has so much productive capability here in this country. It's weakening the price relative to the foreign oil benchmark.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that we hit 11.3 million barrels of production, surpassing Russia as the world's largest oil producer. Gary, a couple final thoughts here on this correction. As we went through the month of October, as stocks corrected, the three sectors that held up well, consumer staples, which looks like it's still breaking out, utilities, healthcare. Any thoughts in terms of market sectors going forward?
Well, those are defensive sectors you just mentioned, and that's what you would expect in a correction, that the cyclicals getting hit hard, the internet stocks getting hit hard, Amazon dropping a stunning 25% and shifting into the more defensive sectors. I think now we're going into the seasonal period, November, December, where the market tends to go up, but we get a Thanksgiving rally, we get a Christmas rally, and 401k rally in January. This is a good time for the stock market, and the buybacks may be enough to help this market go higher yet. So I wouldn't be surprised, based on prior price action of similar magnitude, that the Dow will and the S&P will continue to work their way higher, maybe perhaps getting back to the close to the highs of the year. And then I think at that point, the rally fizzles out. And the tightening of Fed policy, $50 billion a month of draining of liquidity, another rate hike in December, another rate hike in the first quarter of next year, we'll put a lid on the rally. And so this will be more of a trader's market now than it has been in the past. It's no longer a one-way up. And of course, the Fed could make a policy mistake if housing prices begin to come down. And that could be a little bit more of a negative for the stock market. So I would say, you can continue to expect this rally to continue short term with the Dow at 26,200, may get back to 26,500 or slightly higher. And then the tightening of Fed policy puts a lid on it. And we could see another 5% pullback from those higher levels.
So if you're an investor, stay invested at least a while longer and ride this upsurge.
Yeah, that's what I would expect. The Fed rate hike in December is largely discounted, but price is everything. And at higher prices, there'll be those who want to take profits. And then once again, the Fed is tightening. It's going to be a much more difficult environment going forward. One has to be more of a short-term trader, but the volatility is enormous. 5 to 10% swings up and down will become the norm, and so you'd be so often surprised just how far the market goes on the upside and the downside in these markets.
All right. Well, listen, Gary, as we close, you have several ways our listeners could find out more about your work. Tell them how they could do so.
Well, I'm on cyberspace at globalmoneytrends.com, and you can go there to see some articles I've written in the past, publish a newsletter on Friday afternoons, and that's where you can find me.
All right. Well, listen, Gary, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great holiday.
You too, Jim. And thank you very much for calling, and have a great weekend.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The split government, I think, is a problem in terms of trying to increase some of the tax incentives and spending programs that were expected, and just a general anxiety over what's perceived as being a very contentious, perhaps investigative legal aspect that is going to be coming from the left in terms of trying to check and balance on the right. So I do think there will be some headwinds there on that front. I don't think they're actually that major in terms of the economic policy. A lot of the incentives are in place. I don't think they can be reversed. I don't think the investigations will go anywhere except to embarrass and try to gum things up a bit. But there's also some intersection of positive side. There's rumors of infrastructure spending that might be a joint vision of the two parties that might come through.
Well, in the latest downturn, if you wanted to go in safe assets, it didn't exactly work this time as it did in February, and it didn't work then. Interest rates held up, and also precious metals did not rally as much as they usually do. What's going on in the precious metals market? Because recently, the U.S. Mint reported selling out of silver eagles. Joining us on the program from KDPM Precious Metals is Kathy Derbis. Kathy, we were talking just before we went on the air there. I think it was in the month of August, the U.S. Mint sold out of silver eagles. And I'm looking at the price of silver and gold. Both have not done well over the last couple of years, but the ratio between silver and gold has never been this high. Can you tell us what's going on in the metals market, if you would?
Absolutely. We'll take the mint first, Jim. So the mint generally fabricates to meet demand. And demand, as you have said, has been down for both gold and silver quite substantially since 2016. So when the price of silver fell from the 16s to the 14s in August, and it fell pretty quickly, demand all of a sudden doubled, and the mint just wasn't ready for it. So they couldn't actually meet the demand of the current order. So what they did was they decided that they weren't going to take any orders for 2 weeks until they could fabricate more and catch up. And that's really all it was. It was just a matter of them trying to meet the orders that they had and then being faced with a sudden doubling in demand, which they couldn't fulfill. So it was only 2 weeks. The premiums, of course, on silver eagles shot up about 40 cents, which is normal. That's what happens when those sort of things happen. But here's the message. The message is that in a paper world where we are so used to pushing the button and buying 1,000 shares of Google or Amazon, that in the physical world where there's a physical product involved, you can't always count on getting what you want, particularly if you want size, for the price quoted, because there are so many other factors that are involved in it, not to mention fabrication, transportation, storage, that sort of thing. And I think that is the message of the mint selling out of silver eagles. And particularly prospectively, we need to think about that as a physical product versus in the mechanics of that versus the paper world that we have lived in for quite a long period of time. So that's really all that happened.
So, Kathy, you know, when silver got down to the low $14 range, it's still in the $14 range today. So basically what happened is physical buyers of precious metals said, at that price, I'm a buyer, and it's people coming in to pick up value.
That's exactly right. Because you can see, I think it's pretty obvious at these prices, that particularly for silver, that it is a great value. It is a great value. And that brings up another point, Jim, is that I see that we allow price to essentially tell us, or we think that it tells us what the value of something is. And that is not always the case. In other words, why do we let price be the determinant of value, particularly when it comes to precious metals? Because the characteristics of precious metals are so much more important than its price. Why do we let it determine its value when what we need it for is that it is real, it's a real asset, it's a monetary asset, it's scarce, it's fungible, it's always withstood the test of time. So I think that that is the way to think about it instead of just allowing its price to tell us what its value is. And of course, what I'm referring to is physical. Now, if it's paper, gold or silver, then, and that's pretty much, in my opinion, for a trade, then I understand it. But in the, on the physical side, there's so many other characteristics of precious metals that we should be thinking of first and foremost before its price. But certainly when all of that comes together and we have a low price, then it is absolutely the time to buy. And I think that's what we saw in late August.
Kathy, do you know approximately what the production cost is for miners? And the reason I ask that is the Wall Street Journal did an article this week, and they talked about a turning point in the commodity market, especially for base metals and metals in general. And that is, a lot of these mining companies have not invested in new mines. And as you well know, even if you found a new mine, sometimes with environmental permits and things like that, it may take you 8 to 10 years to bring a mine into production. And in some cases, a lot of mines have been shuttered because the governments haven't allowed it. So given the fact that miners have been buying back stock, increasing dividends, and this is going on in the energy industry, there's been a lack of investment. And so what the Wall Street Journal was talking about, given the fact that global growth will continue to expand, especially in the emerging market, and, you know, we buy cell phones, we buy all kinds of electronic gadgets, and a lot of those use metals in some form or another, sooner or later, the price is going to have to catch up because you can't keep doing this. Otherwise, we're going to have shortages.
Right. I think what you're referring to is the scarcity factor of precious metals and how incredibly difficult it is to actually mine them and fabricate them and bring them through the system. And that particular process, they've become even more scarce. They're, like you said, there haven't been any major finds in the last really couple of decades, not major finds. There are some of the miners that have what they think could be some major reserves, but we'll see going forward if those actually come to pass. But what is happening is that the miners, and you know, we don't do miners, we're all into physical gold and silver, but essentially the miners, which is a very difficult business, have done everything they can in an incredibly difficult environment to bring their costs down and to bring as much metal as they can to market as possible in this particular environment. But it's still scarce, Jim. It's scarce and it's still a very difficult business. And I don't think that prospectively we can count on some major, major finds in order to increase the supply. So what would have to adjust, as you said, would be the price. And that's exactly where I think we are now. I mean, I'm very excited about where we're going prospectively in the metals market, because it looks to me as though we've had a change of behavior in all major markets. We've seen that. We've seen it in equities. We've seen it fixed income. And we're certainly seeing it in the commodity markets. And what that tells me is that finally, the truth about what has been propelling markets and distorting asset values for the last 8 to 10 years is going to be revealed. And of course, what I'm referring to is the central bank's fiat monetary experiment. And as we go forward, if we see that that experiment is going horribly wrong, in other words, the central banks are trapped, that sort of thing. Gold and the precious metals will rally as a safe haven, which is exactly what it's for. And Jim, you know, this could actually be gold's and silver's last major rally. I don't know, but it appears it's possible because, and that doesn't mean that it'll come down again. It just means that if it goes back into the system, even in the smallest way, probably led by China backing the currency is what I'm talking about, then it will find its own level a lot higher than where we are now. And that's what makes me very optimistic about the future and really, really bullish about physical gold and silver, which is the message that I'd like to get to everyone is that, you know, everyone needs an allocation to physical gold and silver for that very reason.
Kathy, you deal with, you know, not only individuals, but you deal with hedge funds and institutions. A lot of the hedge funds, typically because of size and leverage and the movement and the disposition towards trading, they tend to go into the futures market. And what reminds me of silver is when I first got involved in silver around 2001, 2002 period, when I discovered silver, it was basically controlled in the futures market at $5. The commercials would sell. When it got down to $4, they would be buyers. And it seems like we're in that sort of same kind of range trading pattern with the commercials taking positions. When, you know, you see silver pop over 15, get up to 16, they tend to be sellers. It gets down into the 14 range, they tend to be buyers. What do you think would be a catalyst to move it? Is it going to take some kind of monetary event? Is it going to take a downturn in the dollar? I mean, the U.S. is facing trillion-dollar deficits well into the next decade every single year. And, you know, we're running trillion-dollar deficits, Kathy, when we have GDP growth in the 3 to 4% range. What happens when we get into a recession?
Well, what you asked is what we think is going to move it. And I think it's always demand, Jim. It's always extraordinary demand for the metal. I mean, we've already seen J.P. Morgan buying quite a lot of silver for their own account. And a lot of that, I think, not just them, but others, is driven by the safe haven demand, which is coming from Eurasia, basically. It's not in the U.S. Demand in the U.S. has been very low and declining over the last couple of years, but it's completely different out of the dollar. And when you get into Europe, particularly Germany, been big buyers. But you also see it, of course, in all of Asia, with in silver and gold, with China, with India. You've seen it in gold in so many of the central banks that Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkey, India, the European central banks, Poland, Hungary, Egypt for the first purchases since 1978, India, Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, even the little tiny Bank of Mongolia has been buying. So I think that demand in the physical world, because it's a much smaller world because it's unlevered, versus what we see in the price of the COMEX, which is highly levered, is what is going to eventually drive it. We're already seeing dislocations between the physical world in size and the COMEX. And you can just look at the SGE data to see what the premiums are there. So it's going to be simple. It's demand in size, which we're already seeing from central banks, other large banks, sovereign wealth funds, and actually individuals. It's just not U.S.-centric. It's pretty much hidden from us, unfortunately. We're going to be the last ones to come to the table because everyone else is already buying. And that is what is going to propel the price higher, even though physical is unlevered. And the leverage, like in the COMEX market, is huge. So I think it'll be that.
When you look at physical metals, you know, the one thing about gold, every ounce of gold that's ever been mined still exists today, either in the form of jewelry, coin, or it could be some artifact in a museum, or a religious artifact. Let's talk about silver. I know at one time a big demand for silver came from photography, and a lot of scrap silver was used from photography as well. If you look at what silver's used in today, it's used in solar panels, it's used in our electronic devices. I just can't see scrap silver. You know, you turn in your iPhone or you turn in your tablet, and they're going to basically use it for scrap. So it seems to me silver has a lot more potential, number one, given the price disparity between gold and silver, but also the fact that a lot of silver that is mined is consumed.
That's exactly correct. You're talking about industrial demand for silver, and it's still continuing. Now, we'll see what happens with that in the technology area if that begins to wane. We'll see. But I don't think that it will matter, because investment demand will overtake any shortfall in industrial demand prospectively. And I think that's exactly where we're almost there. We're almost to that point where we're going to see that, which, of course, with silver being such a tiny little market, that any type of major investment demand will propel the market higher. And we're probably just on the cusp of that, Jim. I can see it happening. I know it doesn't feel like it when we're down in the 15s and silver being down this year, what, 15, 16%. But it's precisely that investment demand for safe havens for both gold and silver that is going to propel it higher. Because silver and gold, as safe havens, have been doing, maybe not in the U.S., but elsewhere, have been doing what they're supposed to do, which is protecting purchasing power. We just don't see it in the U.S. because we've been in a different situation here. The dollar is higher. The U.S., you know, the dollar price of gold has been down. But you look at the price in other currencies, and it's a completely different story. So it's a matter of the U.S. coming to the investment demand that the rest of the world is already seeing. And when that happens, particularly in silver, in this tiny little market, there is no telling where the price is going to go. And there's no telling what, in terms of the physical product, that we will be able to provide to our clients. I'm not saying that we'll have a shortage. I'm just saying that anything in size will probably be bought at much higher prices. So I agree with you. It's probably going a lot higher. I don't know the timing, but I feel like we're on the cusp of that right now.
Kathy, what are your hedge fund clients doing? Because typically they tend to be trend followers. If a trend is, if I don't care, it could be a commodity stock, could be interest rates or a currency. If it's going up, they buy. They tend to be more on the momentum side. Something's going down, they short or sell. What are your hedge fund clients doing with silver and gold at these levels?
They're using it to hedge. They're using it to hedge portfolio risk and market risk, and which is exactly what gold and silver are for. It is a hedge against that. And so in that case, they understand, they can see the bigger picture, the big paper picture of what is going on in all the traded markets, and they want something real. They want a real asset that they can count on that doesn't have counterparty risk. I mean, you know, Jim, we all know the world is awash in debt, right? Which is just, debt is just a promise to pay. A promise. A promise to pay is not money, and it's certainly not wealth. So some individuals and these hedge funds, they are looking for no counterparty risk. They're looking for a way to get to hedge whatever is coming our way in terms of the paper markets, which, as I said, look to me like they've had a change of trend. So, you know, when you look at it that way, I don't know that a lot of them are using physical silver and gold as reserves for cash. I don't think that is where they are now. I think it's mostly a hedge, but certainly prospectively, I can see where they would use it as a cash reserve in their portfolio, precisely because it has no counterparty risk, which, of course, bank deposits and treasury bills and any other type of debt has counterparty risk. So the smart ones are looking forward to what they feel like is coming in all of the traded markets right now and using it as a hedge. And I suspect going forward, we'll have quite a few of them using it as reserves in addition to being a hedge.
So, Kathy, for our listeners, if somebody was to start out in precious metals, of course, you recommend physical, which is what your company does. Do you recommend not only just taking delivery, because I know a lot of people sometimes will buy silver, they'll leave it in storage, or even, you know, the big guys, when they buy contracts, they may leave it at the COMEX. So you, when you buy something, you want to make sure it's secure, you own it. What do you recommend listeners do?
Well, you're exactly right, because the only way to have no counterparty risk in your physical metal is to store it privately, where it's in your control. That is an issue, I realize, and it's probably storage is probably one of my most asked questions. And there, I don't think that there is a perfect answer for that. Storing at home obviously has its own risk. The other option is storing it in private depositories. And there are some good depositories out there that you can trust. Most of them are privately owned, so it's a different set of questions that you have to ask them, mainly who maintains direct legal title to it, because you want it to make sure it's on your balance sheet and not theirs in case something happens and they fail. You don't want to stand behind all their creditors for your gold and silver. But we have a list of questions that we always tell our clients to ask whenever they're considering a depository. But I would do one of those two things, a private depository or something that is in your direct control, one of those two. I don't think leaving it in contracts that has other counterparty risk that you probably do not want to take on. I certainly wouldn't want to have that type of risk, but you want to make sure that it is in your possession or stored in some place that you absolutely can trust and can get to within a short period of time.
Yeah, because you know, you're bringing up a key point there. One of the reasons you would own precious metals is a counterparty risk. It's not somebody's IOU in the case of debt or equity. So if you do possess something that's real, like precious metals, you don't want it in a place where somebody can lease it out or the institution that holds it could get into financial trouble as well. Kathy, as we close, if our listeners would like to talk to you about precious metals, how could they do so?
Thanks, Jim. Well, they could call us 214-750-7300, or you could email me at any time with Kathy with a K, K-A-T-H-Y, at KDPM, like Kevin David, Paul Mary, KDPM.com.
All right. Well, listen, Kathy, thank you so much for joining us on the program and filling us in on the precious metals market. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. It's always good to talk with you.
And in hour two, the big picture, the midterm elections have changed the political makeup of Washington this week. What will a divided Congress mean for the economy and the markets? And in today's big picture, Jim Poplava and myself discuss the headwinds to Trump's tax and infrastructure plans and the key proposals for compromise in 2019. Also in the big picture, we discuss Cold War 2.0 and a movement toward what could be a great power confrontation between the U.S. and China. That's coming up in hour two, the big picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. be advised that you invest at your own risk.